Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program Number 633, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This program is being recorded on May 11th of 2008. And again, as I said on Side 2, Happy Mother's Day, and on this broadcast, we are not going to be talking about mothers, we're talking about mothers. And there's no more of a mother than Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian fascist, media mogul, and former P2 member, who has now become the head of Italy for the third time. And his coalition government involves Gianfranco Fini, head of the Alleanza Nazionale, the Italian, quote, post-fascist party. And they are doing their thing in Italy once again. By the way, the last time that Berlusconi got elected, again, he declared himself, his coalition was declared to be post-fascist. Gianfranco Fini declared himself to be a post-fascist and disowned his previous statement that Mussolini was the world's greatest statesman. But a member of this post-fascist, touchy-feely, you-don't-have-to-worry-about-us, we've-changed-our-stripes coalition was none other than Pino Rauti of Ordine Nuovo. Pino Rauti was a veteran of the Salò Republic, the rump fascist state that was set up in northern Italy by the SS after they invaded Italy, after the Italians had surrendered to the Allies in 1943. And again, the SS set up a rump fascist state in northern Italy, and Pino Rauti was a member of that, and Pino Rauti was also the head of the Ordine Nuovo, or New Order in English, an Italian fascist terrorist group that was basically instrumental in the years of lead and the strategy of tension. Pino Rauti one time said of the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the middle phase of Italian fascism, between the fascisti of Mussolini and the Alleanza Nazionale of Gianfranco Fini, the aforementioned Pino Rauti said of the MSI, he said, too many double-breasted suits, not enough cudgels. And he was part of the Berlusconi-Gianfranco Fini coalition the last time they got elected, and so the violence that we looked at in Side 1, where no sooner does Berlusconi get elected than soccer hooligans kill somebody at a game, this is really not, should not surprise us. Now, I'm going to jump right in, and we're going to resume the discussion where we left off on Side 1. This is an article, an op-ed column by Gaiter Stewart, G-A-I-T-H-E-R is the man's first name, and the article is titled, The Winds of Fascism Blowing Across Europe. It's from Online Journal's issue of May 8th of 2008. And we're going to overlap ever so slightly with the information discussed on Side 1, talking here about Berlusconi's Falange, as he called himself. That is the name of Francisco Franco's fascist party. And Gaiter Stewart writes, as I write these lines, Berlusconi's Falange is occupying every nook and cranny it can get its hands on in the country people of the world so love. First, Berlusca swept the elections to become the new leader. Then, on the heels of his blitzkrieg, the fascist heirs of the old fascist party, who now call themselves post-fascists, collected the magnificent capital city of Rome and ancient capital of Europe. 50-year-old mayor Gianni Alemano calls his Celtic cross a symbol he removed from the body of a fallen fascist companion and that he never takes off. A street warrior, he was during Gli Anni di Piombo, the so-called Years of Lead, because of the bullets zipping through the air as left and right battled on the streets of Italy in the 1970s and 1980s. Gianni Alemano, the former youth leader of the neo-fascist Italian social movement, the heir of Mussolini's fascist state, is the first proto or ex or neo or, as fascists prefer, post-fascist mayor of Rome. Installed on the Campidoglio on the last day of April, Alemano announced matter-of-factly that his first two measures would be to remove the 20,000 Roma gypsies encamped in the city and many along the Tiber River. Roma go home, as if gypsies had a home. Then he will demolish American architect Richard Meyer's brand-new monumental museum that houses the shrine of Arapaces, the Emperor Augustus's altar of peace dating back to January 30th, 9 BCE, which the right disliked from the start while the former left mayor was building it, even though it has become a top tourist attraction in the city center. And then he set about naming a string of fascist cronies into his city administration. Italy has not just shifted rightwards out front of the rest, as often in its past, a test tube for West Europe, but in fear of the artificially created fears of immigrants and terrorists, it has literally hurtled to the right. First, swarms of Italians shoot in Berlusconi and his fascists and his alliance of the Autonomous Federalist Separatist Northern League and another autonomous party in the south. Then, Romans came out for Mayor Alemano and his band of proto-neo or ex-post-fascists. This new Italy of the right, already called the Third Republic, intends negating not just the outgoing center-left government and its actions. Berlusconi has already made his voice heard at East and West, and especially at the European Union in Brussels. He personally will arrange for gas for Italy from the Russia of his friend Putin. He will nationalize Alitalia Airlines against all rules to the contrary. He will do what he likes. Rome is not only the capital city modernized by 15 years of left-wing mayors. Traditionally, it is also a stronghold of the left, the pride of the left, with its efficient mayors speaking a modern cultural language open to experiments and development pointed towards the future. Italy's capital in the hands of the Alleanza Nazionale, fascism's direct heir, is an anomaly, as is the country's new political geography. The north, with its capital of Milan, belongs to the autonomous Northern League. The south, including Calabria and Sicily, to the southern autonomist movement, Rome to the fascists, and Italy to Berlusconi. The transformation of Italy's map couldn't be more radical. This event is not a normal alternation in power between two similar parties. This is an electoral earthquake. Even Alemano was the last to expect his victory in Rome. It was taken for granted that the left would win again. The post-fascist victory changes the face also of Italian politics. The center-left, the reformist Democratic Party, headed by Rome's ex-mayor and ex-communist Walter Ventroni, who dared run alone, lost its bet. In the elections, it lost also the radical left, the communists, socialists, and other small left-leaning parties with which it refused to run. The sad reality is that the resurgence of the right-wing vote would have swept away any combination of the left. The outcome testifies to a majority of a real right in the nation. Italy's municipal and national elections were not about programs which were similar. Neither Berlusconi nor the new mayor of Rome was elected for their programs. People wanted discontinuity, a new direction, even if it smacked of the old. As nonsensical as the alternative choice of Silvio Berlusconi and Rome's post-fascist seems, people voted against the political cast. Rome electors of both right and left leapt onto Berlusconi's bandwagon. The right vote in Rome and Italy bears an indelible anti-establishment stamp, the same as in most of Europe during the last 2 years. It is both a nationalistic and sometimes an anti-European Union voice. Xenophobic, anti-immigrant, and anti... Beginning again. This too needs some editing. It is both a nationalistic and sometimes an anti-European Union voice, xenophobic, anti-immigration, and anti-globalization, the voice of the populist spirit sweeping across the continent. For many, the center-left, the left in general, is perceived as an extraneous foreign body. At the same time, populist Berlusconism in Italy and the anti-Europeanism in Sarkozy's France and in Tory Great Britain avoid old rules and old commitments. The European right is instead marked by a Janus-like duality. It is both establishment and outsider, rebelliousness and professionalism, anti-politics and political caste, ideological and anti-ideological. And the deception works. Here's a look at this new post-fascist Italy. On a national level, Gianfranco Fini, president of the Neo-Fascist National Alliance, has become the new president of the Chamber of Deputies, the third in rank in the Italian state. Fascists will occupy 2 of 12 major ministries backed by a horde of fascist deputy ministers and undersecretaries. In Rome, as in other cities, provinces, and regions throughout the country, ex-fascists are stepping into positions of power. Skipping down. Actually, speaking about this same phenomenon in Europe as a whole, actually, it didn't happen from one day to the next. In retrospect, however, it seems to have come about suddenly while Italy was busy watching the experiment with its first real center-left government, a coalition of the center and the radical left, including communists. For 20 months or so, the experiment limped along, stumbled, and then collapsed over a bagatelle. New elections brought Italy back to the main body of Europe, in which the right is either a majority or at the helm of state of the four biggest countries with a combined population of nearly 300 million. Besides Italy, Germany, France, and Great Britain, the latter still formally governed by a Labour Party leaning rightwards and today in a minority in the Tory-dominated nation. Despite its broad national roots, the British Labour Party lost heavily in local elections this past weekend, including the boss of the mayorship of London to the Conservative candidate, in substance resembling the simultaneous rout of the left in Italy. The painful price the UK left must now pay for the disastrous alliance of Tony Blair with Bushy in America. In Germany, the Christian Democrats govern in a coalition with the Social Democratic Party that chose an alliance with the right rather than with the left of socialists and communists of the Linke, the same choice of the center-left Democratic Party of Italy had made. In France, Nicolas Sarkozy last year rode roughshod over the center-left socialists and at the same time crushed both the extreme right of the National Front and the French Communist Party on the left, certified by the bourgeoisie for his crushing of the impertinent uprisings in the Paris banlieue when he called the sons of immigrants the, quote, scum of the nation, unquote. In 2007 elections in Greece, the center-right New Democrat Party won in close elections, while in the Netherlands and Belgium, the Netherlands and Belgium are both governed by a coalition of center-oriented Christian Democrats and Social Democrats. In Portugal in 2006, the center-right Social Democratic Party won presidential elections over the center-left Socialist Party. Also in 2006, Sweden, which had been dominated by the Social Democratic Party since 1932, accounting for Sweden's broad social system, fell to the center-right Alliance for Sweden. A similar right-leaning model rules in most states of Eastern Europe, today still searching for an acceptable social-political model. Emblematic of the times in the East, the Ukraine is displaying its confusion by renaming its streets. Tolstoy Street becomes John Lennon, and Maxim Gorky cedes to Abraham Lincoln. Is it any wonder, then, that I am sick, malato, malade, enfermo, crank? That I am a lonely paranoiac staggering under the onslaught of legions of continental Chichikovs? Only in Spain, tough Germanic Spain, standing like a proud and lonely Don Quixote, only in Spain does a socialist party govern, today the most progressive land in Europe. But it, too, is under its neoliberalist fire. Lonely but in neoliberalized and intolerable Spain, a socialist who dares to keep his word on withdrawing troops from Iraq, lonely and criticized also by the left for daring to lean on conservatives to push through his program. Oh God, how to do the right thing? But not to worry, the right says, Zapatero's new four-year term will pass quickly, after which Spain's fascist right can leap back onto the center stage. In the wake of the spread of uniformity and the gospel of order and security, one might wonder if all these center-right governments are in cahoots. It would seem so. Is this the real face of the European Union? It seems so. Is this part of the world government New World Order process? It looks like it. Yes, indeed, and one should remember, as I've discussed in, among other programs, For the Record 305, and in numerous discussions of the Bormann Capital Network, the economic facet of a Third Reich gone underground, it dominates the European economy and also much of the rest of the economy, much of the economies of the rest of the world. So this really shouldn't be all that much of a surprise. We're going to travel to a country that bridges the gap, or literally stands between Europe and the Middle East, and indeed culturally and politically it is sort of a midway point between Europe and the Middle East. That is Turkey. And in Turkey, too, there has been some discussion of an investigation of a shadowy right-wing terror network that appears to be composed, at least according to its critics and investigators, composed of some of the pan-Turkist fascists of the National Action Party, the best-known member of which was Mehmet Ali Aja, who shot the Pope. And indeed, in a For the Record show, we took a look at how the Operation Gladior, Turkish component of Operation Stay Behind, may very well have provided some of the support for Mehmet Ali Agca when he shot the Pope. And again, although it was foisted off on the public as a Soviet/Bulgarian crime, in fact, the shooting of the Pope appears to have been the work of an international fascist milieu, the P2 Lodge being central to it, but the Turkish fascists of the Grey Wolves in the National Action Party being an essential component of that. We're going to take a look at an article now from the British Guardian. This article is by Jason Burke in Istanbul. It's dated May 4th of 2008, headlined, Mystery of a Killer Elite Fuels Unrest in Turkey, and it reads in part as follows. It has the elements of a thriller. A shadowy group of right-wing former soldiers, a mafia don, extremist lawyers and politicians, hand grenades in a rucksack, plots to kill the Prime Minister and a Nobel Prize-winning writer, allegedly planted evidence and falsified wiretaps. Even the name of the villains, the Ergenekon Network, has an airport paperback flavor, and the stakes involved are high. The stability of one of the world's most strategically important countries. This highly charged political reality is splitting Turkey. In the coming days, the Ergenekon investigation will reach its climax. According to newspaper reports, a long-awaited indictment will be issued by the state prosecutor. After successive waves of arrests, 47 people are in custody. They include senior figures in the ultra-right-wing Workers' Party, a dozen retired senior army officers, journalists, and a lawyer accused of launching legal attacks that drove Nobel Award-winning writer Orhan Pamuk from his homeland. Crimes being blamed on the Ergenekon network include a series of murderous bomb blasts, a grenade attack on a newspaper, the murder of an Italian bishop, and the killing last year of the Turkish-Armenian journalist Raut Dink, all aimed, investigators believed, at creating a climate of terror and chaos propitious to a military coup that would depose Turkey's moderate Islamist government. This coup attempt has revealed deep divisions in Turkey's 73 million-strong population over the country's identity, pro-European or anti-European, fiercely nationalist, ethnically homogeneous and militaristic, or globalized and pro-Western, more or less Islamic, more or less sunk in historical bitterness and dark conspiracy theories. The cleavage is deep. Every institution, every social class, everybody is divided, said Professor Murat Belge of Bigli University, Istanbul, an analyst. I am deeply apprehensive about what is going on now and what might happen. But for Mehmet Demirlek, a lawyer defending a colleague accused of being a key member of Ergenekon, the allegations are, quote, imaginary, unquote. There is not a shred of truth in it, and they said this is 100% political. It has all been cooked up by the government and by the imperialist powers, the CIA, Mossad, and the Jewish lobby, and the European Union to eliminate Turkish nationalism. There is no such thing as Ergenekon, unquote. His imprisoned client, Kemal Kerenişiz, told The Observer in an interview prior to his arrest that he was a, quote, patriot fighting the disintegration of the nation, unquote. For Fethiye Setin, a lawyer representing Raut Dink's family, Ergenekon has existed for years. A small part of what has previously been hidden is being exposed. Call it the deep state, unquote. An investigation was launched by state prosecutors after 27 hand grenades said to be the make used by the military were found in a home in a rundown part of Istanbul last June. Investigators claim that they later uncovered an underground network dedicated to extremist nationalist agitation. Wiretaps led to further finds of explosives, weapons, and documents listing security arrangements of senior political and military figures and death lists. The papers, supposedly proving Ergenekon the name of a mythic mountain in Asia where the ancestors of the Turkic peoples escaped the Mongols, was set up in 1999 as a clandestine and violent organization aimed at maintaining a reactionary, purist vision of a strong militaristic Turkey, the heritage the extremists believe of the founder of the nation, Kemal Ataturk. The plotters tap, quote, into a psyche that is based on a new and extreme nationalism, said Cengiz Kandar, one of Turkey's most prominent journalists. The idea is that to preserve Turkey, it is necessary and legitimate to resist in any way. And anyone who is pro-European, liberal, who argues for increased rights for minority, and so on, is a traitor. According to Kondar, this new nationalism is the result of a coincidence of factors. The difficulties of Turkey's accession to the European Union, soul-searching over nation identity generated by the debate on Europe, the emergence of a strong semi-autonomous Kurdish state in post-Saddam Iraq with all the potential implications that that has for Turkey's large Kurdish population, and, perhaps most importantly, the continuing electoral success of the AKP, the Justice and Development Party, the moderate Islamist party led by Recep Tayyip Erdogan to power, in 2002. With no way of ousting him through democratic means, other means become attractive to the extreme nationalists. This country has a long tradition of such actions, said Kondar. Turkey's political history has been marked by interventions by the army, each preceded by a period of violent instability and each justified by the need to preserve the constitution and the nation. The repeated electoral success of the AKP, its social and economic policies, its pro-European, pro-free market stance, the growth of newly wealthy, religiously conservative middle classes who vote for Erdogan and his colleagues, and the party's break with fiercely secular ideology, all threaten the nation's powerful military and bureaucratic establishment. A legal bid to ban the party on the grounds that it wants to impose Sharia law on Turkey and thus overturn the constitution is one tactic, AKP party loyalists say. Violence and the activities of Ergenekon is yet another. Quote, how long are these people going to keep their power when it is incompatible with a European, fully democratic Turkey, asks Belge. And how big is Ergenekon? Who are they? How high does it go? Unquote. No official military spokesman would comment, but General Haldu Somartsurk, who retired 3 years ago, told The Observer, quote, the Ergenekon group is trivial, barely worthy of attention, saying that though it was possible a few military officers might have become involved in the group, the vast majority of Turkish soldiers were, quote, committed to maintaining democracy, unquote. Somaztürk, who had said his own views reflected those of most senior soldiers, insisted that, quote, there are far more grave problems facing Turkey than a handful of right-wing crazies, unquote. Instead, he said, it was the government that worried him. The AKP are a concern. There is no such thing as moderate Islam. Either a government is influenced by religion or it isn't. And if it is, then it is not secular and not democratic, he said. We want to move democracy forward. They want to move it back. And we are approaching a point of no return. Well, indeed, I would add as a concluding note that it would appear that Turkey is, to a certain extent, between the proverbial devil and the deep blue sea. Although the AKP are described as moderate Islamists, in fact, they have strong links to the Bank al-Taqwa Muslim Brotherhood milieu, the milieu of Ahmed Huber, protege of the Grand Mufti, protege of Haj Amin, not Haj Amin al-Husseini, but protege of Omar Amin von Leers, nay, Johann von Leers, who was in charge of anti-Semitic propaganda for Nazi Germany, then converted to Islam, and was appointed head of the Institute for the Study of Zionism by Nasser of Egypt. So on the one hand, they do have a moderate Islamist party in power. On the other hand, that moderate Islamist party doesn't appear to be necessarily all that moderate when one looks at some of its roots. And on the other hand, the secular nationalists of the Ataturk variety do have a pan-Turkist fascist element involved with them. So it remains to be seen what happens. In a past miscellaneous articles and updates show, we took a look, and in a past broadcast, I'll put the notation in the description for the program, we took a look at an interesting conspiracy theory that has cropped up among the secular right in Turkey, that namely that Islamists were created by the Jews in order to destroy moderate Islamic governments. Kind of like what we saw with the Church of the Creator, where the guy is saying Christianity has become a pawn in the hands of the international Zionist conspiracy. Well, that, I'll tell you, it's pretty, pretty darned interesting to me. So it remains to be seen what happens in Turkey. Sounds kind of like what's going on in Italy, where they've got this clandestine paramilitary network that is doing its thing. There are a lot of other articles we can deal with. I'm going to try to fit one more very quickly in here. By the way, if some of the pronunciations of some of those names, and admittedly I'm winging it a bit with some of those Turkish names, if they're confusing, check out the description of the broadcast when it goes up, because you'll be able to read the names for yourselves. We're lastly going to conclude with a look at the CDU funding scandal, a very, very complex development in the 1990s, which resulted in, among other things, the Leuna synthetic oil facility in the former East Germany, founded by IG Farben, and during World War II, the largest synthetic oil facility of the Nazi economy. The old Leuna facility was bought out by ThyssenKrupp, and lo and behold, the Fischer-Tropsch hydrogenation process is coming back into use. And the central point man in the CDU funding scandal was Karl-Heinz Schreiber, who is an exile or has sought refuge in Canada. We're going to conclude with this article. This is a Reuters story, Dateline November 29th of 2007. German arms dealer extends scope of favor charges. It reads in part, an arms dealer wanted on fraud charges in Germany on Thursday sought to draw the government into a political storm over cash payments to a former prime minister, saying a request to Prime Minister Stephen Harper to help him avoid extradition was, quote, well received, unquote. German-Canadian businessman Karl-Heinz Schreiber told a parliamentary committee that former progressive conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney had raised his case with Harper last year, quote, and the message was very well received. Both Harper and Mulroney have denied even discussing Schreiber's case, but a series of allegations by Schreiber have proved a thorn in their sides. Schreiber made some of the allegations during a prolonged legal fight to avoid extradition. In our previous coverage of the CDU funding scandal, Schreiber was described as a major string puller, something of an Eminence grease, and was formally compared to Licio Gelli, the head of the P2 Lodge in Italy, as someone who sort of was a puppet master. And indeed, that was one of the many nicknames of Licio Gelli. So again, note the spread of fascism, not really the spread of fascism, but the reemergence of fascism around the world, and note some of the links between those things. Now, again, for the record, it's a very pedantic broadcast. It is sort of a hybrid form of broadcasting. It is meant to be read as well as listened to. So if you only listen to the program, please do take advantage of the vast and ever-growing amount of printed information available to supplement these broadcasts. First of all, www.spitfirelist.com, maintained by Heroic Al of Spitfire. Also, the vast and growing For the Record blog and For the Record supplemental sections being further developed by an equally heroic listener back east, and also the many websites, the websites maintained by sister station WFMU, the heroic WFMU, right across the river from Ground Zero in New Jersey, and WFMU has all of the For the Record shows available for either streaming or for download on Real Audio. This concludes For the Record program number 633, Miscellaneous Articles and Updates. This is being recorded on May 11th of 2008. Happy Mother's Day. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.